I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. If you've been on social media these past few weeks, you've probably seen by now the Ice Bucket Challenge, videos of people drenching themselves and daring their friends to do the same to raise awareness of Lou Gehrig's disease. The Ice Bucket Challenge has grown so popular that even celebrities are doing it. Other online sensations over the years include the Korean Gangnam Style music video and the Harlem Shake. But why do some internet videos go viral when others flounder? My guest this hour is Wharton marketing researcher Jonah Berger. He's written a book about what it takes for things to truly catch on. The science behind commercial contagions. That's next on Midday, after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Nice to have you with us again. Thanks for making Midday part of your day. Not long ago, if you called something viral, it meant bad news. Sorry, you have viral pneumonia. Today, when something goes viral, it's usually good. Consider an obscure Korean rapper named Park Jae-sang, who goes by the professional name Psy. Psy produced a modest but quirky music video in Korean that for some unknown reason went viral on the internet. That means people watched it, liked it, and passed it on to their friends, who passed it on to their friends, and so on, until YouTube reported more than 1.5 billion views. That catapulted Psy from an unknown into a superstar virtually overnight. While this is an extreme case, our next guest can cite dozens of examples to prove that viral marketing, the digital age form of word of mouth, is an amazingly effective way to get people to buy into your product or idea or even your favorite charity. His new book called Contagious, Why Things Catch On, argues that viral marketing may be a matter of luck, but doesn't have to be, nor does it require the internet. One of Jonah Berger's favorite examples involves a restaurateur in Philadelphia who wanted to create a buzz about his new ultra-chic eatery, so he created the ultimate dish for Philly food snobs, a $100 cheesesteak. It was a good cheesesteak, but so outrageous that people talked about it all over town. They're still filling the seats in that restaurant. After years of studying the phenomenon of products, people, and ideas that go viral, Jonah Berger, a marketing researcher at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, says that they often have common attributes, including social currency, emotional resonance, public exposure, and a practical value. On the downside, a viral campaign can cost a company millions. Consider the country singer who produced a slick anti-United Airlines video when the carrier's baggage handlers destroyed his expensive guitar. More than 12 million potential travelers watched it. United eventually paid for the guitar, but suffered millions worth of bad publicity. You want to know more? Jonah Berger is the James C. Campbell Assistant Professor of Marketing at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, our guest this hour. At the Wharton School, his teaching and research awards include the title of the Iron Professor. He's the author of dozens of scholarly and popular articles and publications that include the New York Times, the Washington Post, Science, Wired, Business Week, and the Harvard Business Review. They cover a wide range of topics, including using baby names to study cultural evolution. Recently, Jonah Berger's turned his attention to the confluence of social interaction and the choices we make, and in particular, how viral marketing, planned or unplanned, can spread the word about any subject from cancer research to blenders. That's the subject of his first book called Contagious, How Things Catch On. It's available from Simon & Schuster. Jonah Berger, welcome to Baltimore and the Midday Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
You know, I come to this those words that I just read there, viral marketing, planned or unplanned. You know, to a lot of us, viral means something that's just sort of organic. It just sort of happens, that it can't be planned. It needs to be authentic and organic, something that just sort of rises out of the ground and happens.
I both agree and disagree with what you said. I agree that viral often seems random. Mm-hmm. It seems like luck. It seems like there's some sort of magic going on. But it is organic. But just because it's organic doesn't mean we can't predict it. There's actually a science behind viral. It is predictable. There are principles again and again that drive things to be viral successes. And so while it might seem like luck without understanding those principles, once we see the principles, we have a new lens to understand these complex phenomena.
So what do we mean by viral anyway? I think we all know, we think we know what it means, but what actually does it mean in the marketing world?
Well, often when people talk about viral, they're talking about online. They're talking about a piece of content that was widely shared, widely viewed in the online space, whether it's a video, a news article, or something else. But we also see similar phenomenon offline. We see trends in food products, for example. Greek yogurt has recently become a big hit in the grocery store. We see trends in cars or movies or management strategies at the office and political ideas. And so the same trends happen offline as well as online.
Now, you've done a lot of studies, and one of your areas of research looking at emailing of newspaper articles, specifically from the New York Times. I want to talk about that in a minute. Tell us, first of all, your students there at Wharton, you're teaching them to sell stuff, to nudge their products or ideas into this viral stream. So how successful can you be when you set out to, actually strategize a viral campaign?
Quite successful. And I think the key idea here is for most small businesses, for most entrepreneurs, maybe even nonprofits or parents on a PTA that want an idea to catch on, you don't need 10 million views. You don't need 50 million people to believe your cause or support your ad. You just need more customers to come to your store, more voters to support your initiative, or more others to support your cause. And so really what this book, Contagious, is about helping ideas catch on from the small local level to the broader national level.
Well, I like the way you list these basic principles that you call with the an acronym or abbreviation STEP, STEPP. What does that stand for our listeners, Jonah?
It stands for social currency, triggers, emotion, public, practical value, and stories. And so each of these principles is something we found again and again drives products, ideas, and behaviors to catch on. And we see them across a number of contexts. And the book is all about explaining how the psychology behind these principles work.
Okay, well, let's go through each one of those. Let's start with social currency. What do we mean by that?
Social currency is the idea that we talk about and share things that make us look good rather than make us look bad. So one of my favorite examples of this is actually a bar in New York. And obviously being a bar in New York is tough. There's thousands of competitors. How do you cut through the clutter and make it big? Well, one smart bar owner actually did something quite different. He hid his bar inside a hot dog restaurant. So you walk down the stairs of this hot dog restaurant, you walk inside, they have all sorts of options, everything from a good morning hot dog with bacon, eggs, and cheese to a hot dog with green onions and pineapple. great hot dogs. I've been there a couple times. I really enjoy it. But off in the corner of this hot dog restaurant is a phone booth, one of those old school ones that Clark Kent used to jump into change into Superman. And if you slide open the door of that phone booth and you walk inside, you'll notice that there's a rotary dial phone on the wall. And if you pick up that rotary dial phone and you dial a number, any number is fine, someone will actually pick up the other line and they'll ask you whether you have a reservation. And you might say, a reservation? I'm in the phone booth inside of a hot dog restaurant. What would I have a reservation for? But if they happen to have space or you happen to have a reservation, the back of that phone booth will open and you'll be let into a secret bar called Please Don't Tell. Now, Please Don't Tell has violated a lot of traditional laws of marketing. No sign on the street, no sign inside the restaurant. They've done everything they can to make themselves a secret. But by making themselves a secret, they've gotten people to talk. They've never advertised, yet every day they're full. And people talk about them because going to a place like that or even knowing about a place like that makes you look cool. It makes you look special and in the know. And so people talk about it because it makes them look sharp.
So to get people talking, we need to craft messages that help them achieve this level of coolness, right? That's in part. To make them look smart. Make us look a little bit like we've got something somebody else doesn't have.
Definitely, and that's only one of the drivers, but it's key here to note that the dimensions that matter are different for everybody. There might be some of your listeners saying, oh God, that sounds amazing, I would love to go to that place. And there might be other people that say, wait, I don't care about restaurants. But everyone has a domain that they care about. For some people, they might be really into golf. Other people might be really into football. Other people might be really into cooking. Other people are foodies. They care a lot about the restaurant scene. Whatever your domain is, the idea that you care about how others see you in that domain. You want to look smart and in the know rather than out of touch and behind the times. And so you talk about things that give you that quality.
Here's another example of that, airline miles. I was so amused by this part of your book. Please tell our listeners about airline miles and how people like to actually talk about them, not so much use them.
It's funny, we think about frequent flyer status as something that gives us something. Oh, you know, we'll get to check our bag for free, and we'll get on a couple minutes early. But most of the reason we care about frequent flyer miles actually isn't that. It's the fact that we get to feel better than everyone else. There was a really neat study that was done at Harvard a couple years ago where they asked people a very simple question. They said, do you want a job that would pay you $50,000 or a job that would pay you $100,000? And if you think about it, everyone would say, well, I prefer the second job, $100,000. Of course that's better than $50,000. But there was one small twist. If you have that job that's $100,000, other people actually make more money than you. They make $200,000. Whereas if you have the job that makes $50,000, other people make less money than you, say $25,000. And so people tended to prefer the job that paid them less money as long as they got more money than everyone else. And so the point here is social comparison. We don't just care about ourselves in abstract. We care about how we compare to the other people around us.
One more story under social currency, and that is the, I love this story about the website called Rue La La.
Rue La La is a great example. There used to be a website called Smart Bargains. They sold a number of different types of products. They sold sort of household goods, clothes, bedding, other sorts of things that hadn't sold at major department stores. And they did okay, but after a few years, there was a lot of competition, sales were down, and the website was sort of tilting towards bankruptcy. Well, their CEO at the time, a guy named Ben Fishman, actually noticed something interesting. While most of the website wasn't doing good, there was a part of it that was doing particularly well. It was this small part of the site where people had to pay an extra fee or give their email address, but they got access to some things everyone else didn't. Special deals, maybe free shipping, a couple of other things. Not amazing stuff, but stuff that made people feel special. So what he did is he took this same idea, this idea of making people feel special, and he rolled it out into a new site called Rue La La. Now, Rue La La is almost the same as Smart Bargains. It sold exactly the same things, but it did so much better. The site took off. It was amazing to see. And all they did that was different is they harnessed social currency. Mm-hmm. They made people feel special. You had to sign up. You had to get advanced access to the site. You couldn't just access the deals. You had to sign up. You had to be let in. And you could only get certain deals at certain times of day. The deals would get posted about 11 a.m., and by 11:30 or 12, they would all be gone. And so people felt like this was scarce and exclusive stuff that they really wanted to get access to, that they had to jump at the chance to try. We can think about the same sort of idea with Gmail. When Google released their Gmail product the first time it was out, you couldn't get access unless you knew someone at Google. And so people felt really special when they had access to one of these addresses, even though it was just a plain old email address.
It's like going into the phone booth and dialing to see if you can get into the Please Don't Tell bar.
Exactly.
And I assume from there people just love to talk about their special access that they had to Rue La La.
Definitely. I mean, the idea here, again, is, you know, if you get invited to a special party or you get a product that not everyone else had, you feel smart and in the know. McDonald's even did this. Do you know the McRib sandwich? You familiar with their sandwich,
oh,
McRib?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're all familiar with that sandwich. But the story behind it is actually pretty surprising. So a number of years ago, McDonald's had essentially run out of chicken. The Chicken McNuggets were so popular, they needed another product. So they introduced the McRib. It does okay, but it doesn't do great. Sales were tepid at best. So they took it off the market, and they re-released it in certain markets at certain times of year. So one time it'll be in Denver, another time it'll be in Indianapolis, another time it'll be available in Baltimore. And suddenly people go crazy for the sandwich. Now that they can't have it all the time, they really want it. In fact, there's a website called the McRib Locator online, which shows you what parts of the country it's available in. for a sandwich that's not even actually rib meat. And so the point here is anyone can apply this idea of social currency if they make people feel special and in the know.
Well, Jonah, we got through principle number one. We'll get to principle number two when we get back from this short break. Jonah Berger, our guest in this hour of midday, a marketing professor at the Wharton School. He's probably watched more awful cat videos than anyone should ever be forced to watch as part of his research into what makes information turn viral. He's written a new book about it called Contagious, Why Things Catch On. We'll talk more about this when we get back. If you have a comment or question for Jonah Berger, please call us at 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, speaking with Jonah Berger, an expert on information, products, and ideas that go viral. He teaches marketing at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He's just written this fascinating book that we're discussing in this hour of the show, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. And Jonah, if you don't mind, before we talk about principle number two in your six principles of how to make this work, I needed to ask you about the title Iron Professor at Wharton. What made you the Iron Professor, and what are the rights, duties, and privileges appertaining to that title?
So here at Wharton, we have a teaching competition where professors get up for 5 minutes. They present 15 slides, one every 20 seconds. They auto-advance. And at the end of it, all the students have to vote on who gave the best presentation. And so it's a little bit like Iron Chef. You have to do it quickly, but it's with research. And I was the lucky winner of that award last year.
Well, congratulations, Jonah. And thanks again for being with us today. We were talking about the six principles as you described them. You know, the key to making an idea really popular lies, you say, in these six principles. We covered the first one, social currency. Now we get to the letter T for triggers. This is pretty interesting, too. Something needs to be top of mind to be on the tip of people's tongues. Let's talk about triggers.
I think the best way to think about triggers is for me to tell you the story of Rebecca Black. So many of us are familiar with Rebecca Black. She had a song a few years ago that was very popular called Friday. But it's an interesting story behind that song. Rebecca was a 16-year-old girl living in California, and her parents paid a company called Arc Music Factory to produce a hit for her, a hit song. And they came out with a slightly overproduced number. She's singing about waking up in the morning, going to school, dealing with those big teenage dilemmas like whether to sit in the front seat or the back seat of her parents' car, you know, all those big hefty things. So the song comes out, and everybody says they hate it, or many people do. Some have called it the worst song ever, which is in itself a sort of an accomplishment. Yet the song has over 300 million views. 300 million views. If it's so terrible, why did so many people watch it? How did it become popular? Well, we decided to look through the data, and we went and we tracked the number of searches for Rebecca Black on YouTube over time. And what we found was they were generally flat, and there was this big spike in attention. It went down for a while, then another spike. It went down for a while, another spike, and so on again and again. But when we looked closer, the spikes weren't random. They were actually 7 days apart. And when you look even closer, you notice that there are a certain day of the week, every single Friday. Now, this song is equally bad every day of the week. It's bad on Monday, bad on Tuesday, bad on Wednesday.
Right.
But because it's named Friday, Friday provides a reminder in the environment, what psychologists would call a trigger, to make us think about the song. Every time Friday the day rolls around, Friday the song is more top of mind, and we're more likely to go check it out and share it with others.
So does that explain the popularity of the Paul McCartney song Yesterday?
a little bit. I think whenever we get nostalgic, right, whenever we think about the past, that song is a perfect song.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of other examples. You can think about peanut butter, for example. If I said peanut butter and, you might say?
Jelly.
Right. And even though I didn't say jelly, you thought about jelly because peanut butter is like a little advertisement for
mm-hmm.
jelly.
Mm-hmm.
Peanut butter, thinking about that thing, makes jelly top of mind. Same thing at the grocery store. Researchers find that if the grocery stores play French music, people are much more likely to buy French wine. And if the store plays German music, people are much more likely to buy German wine. And so these subtle triggers in our environment can have a big effect on how we behave.
Jonah, do you live in Philadelphia?
I do.
So if you live in Philadelphia now and someone says cheesesteak to you, you might think of South Philly cheesesteak, but you it's more likely you're going to think of the Barclay Prime cheesesteak.
And the point here is, even if you don't actually go buy the Barclay Prime Cheesesteak, there's so many cheesesteak places in Philly. People in Philly, often when someone comes into town, they say, oh, where should I take you? What cheesesteak place would be best? And so we think a lot about cheesesteaks, which makes the $100 cheesesteak a perfect story to roll out during that conversation. Even though we're not thinking about it necessarily, the fact that cheesesteaks are top of mind makes the $100 cheesesteak top of mind as well.
And we might not even buy the cheesesteak, although we might go to Barclay Prime to watch other people maybe order a $100 cheesesteak.
Oh, definitely. And it makes us, again, it has that social currency aspect. It makes us look smart to know of such an interesting food item.
And that really worked for that restaurant, Barclay Prime. They actually marketed a $100 cheesesteak. It created a buzz, and the restaurant's been successful?
It's been amazingly successful. I mean, there are dozens of high-end steakhouses in Philadelphia. Many do not stick around. They are here one day, gone the next. But Barclay has stuck around for over a decade now. And part of that success revolves around that $100 cheesesteak.
And Jonah, before we leave the trigger principle, another example of this that seems kind of inadvertent is the Mars candy bar. This is an interesting story. Mars candy bar sales went up when NASA's Pathfinder project to Mars generated lots of excitement.
So a number of years ago, NASA had their big mission to Mars. They
right.
landed this Pathfinder satellite on the surface of the Red Planet. Mars was in the news a huge amount over those weeks and months. Everyone was so excited about this new development, the new technology, the patriotism, thinking about Mars. Not surprisingly, toys, Mars rover toys, the little rover that went on the planet, sales of that went up. But interestingly enough, sales of Mars candy bars went up as well. And you might say, well, hold on. Mars candy bars aren't even named after Mars, the planet. They're named after the Mars family founder. And you'd be right. But the point is that when we're thinking more about Mars, Mars the candy bar is also more top of mind. And so these triggers, again, can have a big impact on how we behave, both what we buy, what we talk about, and even how we vote.
But that could lead to a spike in sales. It may not be something lasting, right?
Certainly. I mean, Rebecca Black, for example, she took advantage of a prevalent trigger. It wasn't just once that people were thinking about Friday. They think about Friday once a week. And so if we're trying to think about, well, what trigger should we link our ideas to, we want to pick something that's frequent in the environment. If I make a song called Leap Day, you know, it might be a really catchy song, Leap Day, Leap Day. That song might do well on Leap Day, but it's not going to do well the rest of the few years where there isn't a Leap Day.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really good if we can link our products and ideas to frequent triggers rather than infrequent ones.
This gets a little tricky. I mean, we're in the age of information overload. Each day I get a report on trends on Twitter, Google Trends, you know, to see what's trending. Like today, trending, Android is trending today, along with North Korea. North Korea, of course, is in the news. But Android in the news, Daddy Yankee, Brittany Griner, the Dallas Mavericks owner, Mark Cuban, saying he'd be willing to give Brittany Griner the opportunity to prove she could play in the NBA. Rutgers is still trending. A couple of sports-related stories there. So, I mean, someone looks at trends and they say, well, that's a trend, but it only lasts for a day or two. How am I supposed to adapt a marketing strategy to something as ephemeral as that?
I agree that some triggers are here today, gone tomorrow, but many are persistent. Cheesesteaks have been big in Philly for years, and they'll continue to be big in Philly.
Right.
Friday happens every day of the week. It'll happen every day of the week, and last time I checked, for all time. People talk about Cheerios a lot. Cheerios are definitely not an exciting product. It's a really boring product, actually. But people talk about it often because they eat breakfast at once a day, every week. And so you're right, there are some triggers that come and go, but there are many that stick around.
The next principle we get to is from the letter E for emotion, and now we get to tap into this seminal study you did on why some articles make the most emailed list, newspaper articles. This is really interesting stuff here. Let's talk about emotion in marketing.
Emotion is a key driver of behavior. It really provides the fire that motivates us to action. And when we looked at it in sharing, we actually found something quite surprising. You might imagine that emotion is all about positive and negative things. There are some emotions that are positive, and there are some negative. And so maybe people might share positive emotions but avoid sharing negative ones. We want to put others in a good mood. We want to look smart and positive ourselves. So we share positive things, but we don't share negative ones. When we looked at the data, though, we found that it was more complex than that. Sure, positive emotions were shared, but there were some negative emotions that were also shared, things like anger, for example. And when we looked deeper, we found that it wasn't just about positivity or negativity, but about how much arousal or activation those emotions induced. So take anger, for example. We often see anger-inducing political rants online or opinion pieces that we disagree with, and lots of people share those. But we also often see funny things that get shared. If you look on YouTube, lots of YouTube is all about just funny, funny content. And you might think that those two emotions are very different. They're completely different. What does anger have to do with humor? But they're actually quite similar. Both anger and humor are high arousal emotions. They're activating emotions. They fire us up, and they get us to take action. And so one of those actions is sharing. Anytime we feel a high arousal emotion, whether positive, like excitement or humor, or negative, like anger, like anxiety, we're more likely to pass things on.
And this was revealed in your study of emailed news articles.
Right. So for that paper, we actually looked at 6 months of New York Times articles, everything from front page news, like political events, national issues, to style, to sports. But we didn't look at which sections are most viral or what authors had the most pieces that were shared. We looked at the psychological drivers of sharing. What about the content itself, the emotions it evokes, for example, led people to pass it on? And what we found was what I just mentioned, this idea of, sure, emotion drives sharing. More emotional articles are more likely to be shared, but some types of emotions drive sharing more than others.
I had occasion just a few days ago to see again the video of Susan Boyle performing on Britain's Got Talent. I forget how many years ago this was now, maybe 2-3 years ago, when she sang I Dreamed a Dream and just blew everybody away. Including Simon, right? So I was looking at it now, Jonah, because I know what happened. I know the whole story. The first time I saw it, I wasn't aware of what was going to happen. Someone said, just watch this video. You'll be blown away. When someone tells you that, you know, your guard's up a bit. Anyway,
yeah.
This time I was looking to see how authentic the whole thing was. And it really did. It really still was very emotional. I guess that would be an example of something that goes viral because of the emotions it taps into.
Certainly. I mean, think back to the first time we ever saw Susan Boyle. She walked on stage. We had low expectations. She seemed like she was out of touch. How could her voice be that good? She was dressed very out of style, and everyone was sort of laughing at her. And then she opens her mouth, and everyone is just awed by her voice, awed by her skill, awed by her singing. That emotion of awe really drove people to pass her video and her story on. That inspirational quality, we often have it in religious experiences or when hearing a really beautiful piece of music or standing in front of a big natural wonder like the Grand Canyon. These awe-inspiring experiences drive us to proselytize, to share with others, to pass along this amazing experience that we've had so that other people can have a similar experience.
We're speaking with Jonah Berger today about his book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. One last story from Under Emotion is the story of David Carroll, or Dave Carroll, and the Sons of Maxwell. This is the story about the guitar that I mentioned early in the show and United Airlines.
So a few years ago, this guy, Dave Carroll, was traveling for a gig. He's a musician, and he travels coach just like the rest of us. But, you know, as many of us know, there's no room in the overheads to check our bags. So he, like many other people, put his bag under the plane and his guitar with it. And then the plane was about to take off when someone pointed out the window and said, "Oh, my God. They're throwing guitars out there." And he looked out the window to see, oh my goodness, someone was throwing his guitar, one of the baggage handlers, throwing his guitar through the air. Now, this is Dave's livelihood, and he knows if the guitar gets broken, he's going to have a really tough time playing his gig. So he rushes to tell the flight attendant, "Hey, you know, stop them, help me out." And as often happens on United Airlines, they didn't listen. They said, "Oh, no, you know, we don't have time to help you. Talk to someone else." We talked to another flight attendant. "No, we don't have time to help you either." Finally talks to a third flight attendant who says, oh, you know, you'll deal with this when you land. Talk to someone at the gate. When he lands, as we've all had this experience, there's no one at the gate. The airport is closed. They just pass the buck to someone else. But when he goes to open up his guitar case, once it comes off the baggage claim, he noticed the guitar head is smashed. He pops open that guitar case. His guitar is ruined. It costs over $1,000 to fix. Now, Dave is unhappy. He's pissed off. He calls United saying, hey, you know, can you help me here? You ruined my guitar. You need to pay for the repairs. And they basically said, you know, who cares? Go fix it yourself. You know, it's not our problem. We don't want to deal with it. And we've all had these negative experiences, but Dave takes this negative experience and he does something with it. He writes a song called United Breaks Guitars about his terrible experience with United. And this song quickly gets 100, 500, 1,000 comments, eventually gets over 100 million views, and United's share price drops over $180 million over that period.
Wow.
And it's an amazing case where it's not a positive emotion, it's a negative emotion. It's anger. We're fired up, we're pissed off, but we want to do something about it to change the world. And so because of that, we share with others.
That's a great story, because Dave had a great story to tell, and he used the internet. I want to contrast that before our next break. I just need to do this with the story of your cousin and the winter coat he got from Land's End.
Well, Land's End has amazing customer service. If you've never experienced it yourself, I highly suggest buying something from there. He had bought a winter coat from Land's End because he needed a really tough winter coat. He had one of those wool numbers that looks very nice but wasn't very warm, so he bought one of those sleeping bag coats we're so used to on the East Coast that looks like a regular sleeping bag with your head popped out of the top. He loves the coat. It's extremely warm, but a few weeks into wearing it, the zipper actually breaks. And now he's devastated. It's the middle of winter. He loves this coat, and he's thinking, how much is it going to cost me to get this thing fixed? So he calls up Land's End customer service and says, hey, I've got this coat. You know, the zipper broke. It was my fault. And he was expecting, you know, that United Airlines-type customer service, it's your fault. Who cares? You know, pay us $200 and wait 6 weeks, and maybe we'll fix it. But instead of that, the customer service representative actually does the exact opposite. They say, oh, we're so sorry that your zipper broke. We'll get you out. We'll get you a new one right away. And he said, oh, my God, you're not going to charge me to fix it? They say, no, we'll send you a new one. And he said, well, look, you know, that's great, but it's the middle of winter. How long am I going to have to wait, expecting to be 2 or 3 weeks? Nope, we'll overnight it to you tomorrow. And now my cousin was amazed, flabbergasted by this great customer service. He wasn't just content. He felt a positive emotion. It wasn't content. It was delight. They really went above and beyond in making him happy. And so one key thing to think about with customer service is expectations are so low. We have such little expectations for customer service that anything good, any little bit of going above and beyond will make that customer happy and will make them spread the word to others.
Yeah, I was just going to say, they will tell everyone else. And look how much you, Jonah, relish telling that story. And now I will enjoy telling that story to other people, too. All right. Well, thanks. We're going to take a little break, Jonah. We'll come back and talk some more. Jonah Berger, our guest, his book is Contagious, Why Things Catch On. You're welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our midday email address is midday@wypr.org. I enjoy reading emails on the air with comments or questions, and we're on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. Very nice comment here about Jonah Berger's book from Daniel Gilbert at the Harvard College. He's the Harvard College professor of psychology and author of Stumbling on Happiness, who says Jonah Berger knows more about what makes information go viral than anyone in the world. We're talking with Jonah Berger this hour about his book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. And you were just telling the story of your cousin and his coat from Land's End. That falls under another one of the principles that you describe in your book, Jonah, stories. We like stories. Stories help sell products or ideas or companies or brands. A better story even than your cousin's is the story of Jared, the Subway guy. Subway's gotten so many miles out of that story of Jared losing. What did he lose? 200 and some odd pounds. Right? And the story held up. People believed it. And I think we still see Jared from time to time, right?
The neatest thing to me about stories is sure, they're entertaining. Sure, they're fun to talk about and share, but they also often have something hidden inside. So we all probably remember the story of the Trojan horse, that famous epic Greeks versus the Trojans battle, 10-year battle, and finally it ends once the Greeks hide inside a wooden horse and get pulled into Troy. But that story isn't just a story, right? It also has a moral. The moral is beware of Greeks sparing gifts, or beware of your enemies, particularly when they're being nice to you. And if you think about it, most stories actually have a moral. So The Boy Who Cried Wolf, for example, is all about not lying, or you can think about The Three Little Pigs, I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down, is all about working hard. And when you realize it, most stories are actually like Trojan horses. Sure, there's an exterior shell, there's some entertaining narrative or something going on, but inside, things come for the ride. Things like morals, for example, or information get carried along by the broader narrative. So take the subway story, for example, about Jared. People love to tell that story because it's so entertaining. Who would have thought a guy could lose so much weight by eating Subway sandwiches? That's amazing. You know, he ate these things for like 6 months straight, and he lost all this weight. But in that story is also hidden some information about Subway. You learn that, wow, Subway must have healthy food. They must have a lot of it because you can eat there for a few months and not get bored.
Yeah.
And it's actually a really effective way to go on a diet. No one's trying to advertise for Subway, but in that story, that Jared story, it acts as a Trojan horse for the Subway brand. The brand gets to come along for the ride.
Jonah Berger, our guest in this hour of midday. This is really interesting stuff. I'm so glad that you bring up in this book the classic example of the Apple logo, Steve Jobs' decision over how to place the Apple logo on the cover of the Mac, of the PowerBook, right? And
yeah.
I have one here in the studio with me, and I've always been – I actually don't know this as a classic story. You guys in marketing do. But I've looked at it for a number – I've had this thing for a couple of years now. I keep looking at that white apple on the cover of the PowerBook. It's not facing me, the user, but when I lift it up or I go to a Starbucks, I see people using it. It is facing me. So this comes under the principle of public. Things need to be public. People need to see them, of course, in order for them to catch on.
The story of the Apple logo is actually something we've all seen the logo on the computer, but it wasn't until I dug a little bit deeper that I found the story behind the logo. So Apple's always been known as a brand that wants to be easy for customers to use. You can remember the first time you got an iPhone and you took it out of the box and you're looking for the instruction manual going, how do I use this thing? And then you realize that, wait, it's so easy to use. I don't need an instruction manual. And the laptop was the same way. And so if you think about it, one issue with a laptop is it's in your bag or you take it out of something and you need to figure out which way faces you. Which side of the laptop has the latch on it that should face you? And so Apple had always used their logo on top of the laptop like a compass, facing the North Star. So if you took that laptop out of your bag and you set it down in front of you, if the logo was facing you, then sure enough, you could open up the laptop and use it right away. But what they realized is when the logo was facing you, the user, it was actually upside down when you opened it.
Yeah.
And you already know what type of computer you're using, but not everyone else does. And so Apple actually went ahead and they flipped the logo, making it harder for the customer to use, but easier for everyone else to see because they realized imitation requires things being public.
Mm-hmm.
We've all heard of that phrase, monkey see, monkey do, and we often think, oh yeah, people behave like others. But we don't as often pay attention to that monkey see part, right? Monkey can only do if monkey can see what another monkey is doing.
Right.
And we're the same way. If we can't see what others are doing, we can't imitate it. Sure, we can imitate someone's shirt, but it's harder to imitate their socks because we can't see them.
So making things more observable makes them easier to imitate, makes them more likely to become popular?
Definitely.
All right.
Think about restaurants, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're trying to figure out where to eat in a part of town you're not familiar with,
yeah.
We often use the trick, well, if it's full, it must be good. We use others as information, but only if we can see what they're doing. We actually analyzed a few million car sales in the United States. And you might think, well, why do people buy a car? they buy it because it's a good price or because it has the room or space that they want. But we actually found that people are more likely to buy a car when their neighbor has bought one recently. You know, even though your neighbor doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your need for a car, the mere fact that they bought one might lead you to be more likely to buy one as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this isn't true only for retail or commercial sales. Let's talk about nonprofits and fundraising in this regard. You have a great story from Australia.
The story of Movember. So if you think about it, most nonprofits have a little bit of a problem, and that is, yep, they want to catch on. They want to get lots of donations, but donation is a pretty private act. We can't often see what other people are donating to. We have no idea what our colleagues at work or our friends donate to. How can you make donation more observable? Well, a few years ago, some folks from Australia had a really clever idea. They wanted to raise money for men's cancers, and so rather than having people run a 5K or do a dance-a-thon, they had people sponsor mustaches. So you could grow a mustache for the month of November. People would sponsor your mustache, and along the way, the money would go to men's cancers. But what's really great about a mustache is it's a public signal of a private behavior. If someone shows up in your office wearing a mustache, a big, let's say, Raleigh Fingers number with the ends turned up, you're going to go, well, what's going on there? Why do you have a mustache? And they'll tell you, oh, I'm supporting this cause, Movember. And even if you don't decide to grow one yourself, you're more aware of the cause and more likely to donate. And so by creating that public signal, they got that initiative to catch on. Now Movember is in dozens of countries and has raised hundreds of millions of dollars for men's cancers, all by making the private public.
Hey, can I take you back to Apple for a moment?
Sure.
I'm curious. People will say it's all about the product. People love the products. I mean, this is practically, for years now, has been a sort of a cult that people who are into Apple products, I remember years ago, you know, that all started off with the computers. People were Apple users or Mac users versus the other side. What do you make of it all? Is it the product or is it the marketing? What was it?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, if the product was terrible, it would be harder for it to catch on, but often bad things went out. Often it's not the highest quality product that wins out at the end of the day. Apple products have always been easy to use, but people also like them because they're a signal of identity. It shows that they are special. Originally, you know, buying an Apple was a way to say, well, I'm not like everyone else. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has a PC. I'm different. I'm special. I'm part of this small group of insiders that has all decided to go with this instead of this other more mainstream product. And so people really felt like they were part of a special club, and that feeling of an insider made them more likely to continue using the product.
So it had that social currency.
Definitely.
Yeah. Another principle, Jonah, practical value. This is a good thing to talk about because, you know, as I was saying before, we're so inundated with information. Making your message stand out when you're trying to market something, an idea, get people interested, this is very challenging. So in that regard, talk about practical value.
Practical value is all about useful information. It's all about giving something to people to help them, to make their lives better off. And you might think, well, okay, that's pretty intuitive, but it's actually sometimes not always intuitive. So think about deals, for example. Sure enough, if there's a really good deal, we want to go get it, we want to have it. But what makes a deal seem particularly good? Let's take a $20 T-shirt, for example. Well, that same deal could be represented as $5 off. That would be $15 for the T-shirt. Or it could be represented as 25% off. 25% would be $5 off, same price for the T-shirt. But research actually finds that 25% off makes people feel like it's a better deal, and that makes them more interested in purchasing it. And so it's not just about the actual deal itself. It's about how people perceive that deal, how the deal is framed, and how that changes their interest in purchasing.
Okay, well then help me with the $3.71 cup of coffee that I bought in good old Baltimore about a month ago. I went into a place, a new trendy place, you know, an old warehouse-type building that's been turned into this cool coffee shop, right? And
yep.
I'm not used to paying $3.71 for just a plain cup of coffee. Just
right.
Nothing special. No cappuccino, no mochaccino, none of that stuff. No chinos at all. Just so what am I responding to there when I grimace at this? or the other people accept it. What's going on there?
Well, I think part of what you're reacting to is what you're used to paying for coffee. Mm-hmm. When you think about coffee, you say, well, coffee used to cost just a dollar. How is $3.71 for coffee? That seems crazy. But in, you know, let's say New York, for example, or another city that's more expensive, people might be very used to paying that much for coffee. And so it's not just about the price of coffee itself. It's really about how that fits with our expectations, what our reference point is, as psychologists would say. If our reference point is 50 cents for a cup of coffee, then wow, $3 seems nuts. But if our reference point is $5, well, $3 seems pretty good. And that's what deals are all about, right? If you think about infomercials, they often say, you know, this set of knives can cut through anything. You might expect to pay $100 or $200, but if you act now, we'll give it to you for $19.99. And what they're subtly doing there is they're setting the reference point high. They're making you think, wow, I would expect to pay this much. It's much less than that. I better go ahead and get it. And because they set that reference point high, it seems like a better deal. And so it makes people want to take advantage of it.
Jonah, a couple of emails I want to read for you. One is from Elise, who says, thanks a lot. Your guest made it impossible for me to continue functioning today without a big, greasy, dripping cheesesteak. You made your point. And then Linda, writing from Stewartstown, Pennsylvania, says that years ago, she says, I bought a loaf of granola bread, which was much more expensive than most others. When I opened it, there was a thick layer of flour on the bottom. It was still edible, but I wrote not to complain, but to advise them for quality control purposes. A few days later, I received a thank you letter with $12 in coupons. And she says, I was so pleasantly surprised. I told everyone, and good for them. Yeah, I think we do work in this marketplace with low expectations for customer service. So when it does happen, we go around and tell everyone about it.
Yeah, and the book, I mean, so I wrote Contagious, Why Things Catch On for two reasons. First, because I just thought it was interesting to understand why people talk about and share some things rather than others. We do it all the time. We can't help but share our experiences, our daily lives, the fact that we got these coupons back from a manufacturer. But one question is, why do we share some things rather than others? And so this book explains that, but it also helps if you have something you want to catch on, whether it's a product, a new idea, an initiative. It'll help you understand the psychology of social transmission and use that to make your own idea more popular.
You didn't mention it in your book. I mentioned it at the beginning of the show, and that was the Gangnam Style video that went viral from this Korean rapper. And then since then, Harlem Shake has been out, and then it's led to all these copycats of Harlem Shake dance videos. What is it about the dance video? Do you have any thoughts about that? Is this a primal, this is primordial thing in humans? You know, we need to dance. It's a tribal thing. What's going on with dance videos?
I think there is some of that, but there's also that idea of public that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. If a video has a dance associated with it, it's much easier to see that other people like it. They don't have to just tell you that they like it. You can see that they like that particular thing, and you're more likely, just like Movember, to go over and ask them, what dance are you doing, or where's that from, or I don't know anything about that, tell me more. And so because of that, it helps it catch on. It acts as a public signal for that private behavior.
And one last question, Jonah. We're short of time here. I just wonder, how would this have all worked 100 years ago? Would it not have worked at all, and we didn't have mass marketing of products? Or even 20 or 30 years ago?
It's funny. People often think word of mouth or viral, and they think, well, it has to involve the web. Mm-hmm. It's all about the web. But actually, when you look at the data, only about 7% of word of mouth is online. 7%, less than one-tenth. Most word of mouth is actually offline, face-to-face, person-to-person, or even over the phone. And so it's not just about the web. People have been sharing word of mouth and telling stories for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Think about our ancestors talking to each other about, well, don't go hunting that way, or avoid eating that berry, it'll make you sick. Word of mouth is just an extension of that, how we've extended that today and how we share things online. Sure, online might change a little bit of what we share, but most of why we share has actually been the same for a long time.
Jonah, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yep. Jonah Berger from the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania. His book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On, is available from Simon & Schuster. Enjoyable conversation. Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our first hour for Midday. Please stay there. We've got a second hour coming up for you after the news from NPR. Dan Roderick's here. Please stay tuned for the news, and I'll see you for the second hour.